Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners, industry leaders who have all been kind enough to give up some of their time to jump on the show and share their stories of personal and professional growth. Today, I am joined by Aaron Kamal. He is the managing director at Ikaika, I believe. Aaron, welcome to the show. After you've just told me the company name, how I got that right? Was it Ikaika, yeah?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, James. And yes, Ikaika, in Hawaiian, that means strong. So Ikaika Health can be translated as strong health.
Oh, I like it. I often ask people about the company name. So I'll perhaps come back to my normal question about how you got into clinical research. But real quick, what was the meaning behind, well, not the meaning behind the name, what was the thought process behind naming it Strong Health?
Yeah, no, great question. I appreciate that as well. So the word Ikaika has always been important to me growing up as Native Hawaiian. When I was in fifth grade, I attended a Hawaiian kind of cultural summer camp, and I was assigned to the Ikaika group. So right. I was roughly 11 years old, I think, at the time, and it just kind of settled in. And so I've always enjoyed the word. When I had a chance to start my consultancy, I decided to go ahead and use that.
Wow, strong connections from fifth grade. Good memory as well, I guess.
Great. Yes. It was a memorable experience for sure.
Awesome stuff. Well, I guess on that subject, you know, taking you back to kind of fifth grade, former life, etc. The question that I always kick off with is, you know, kind of how you got into or fell into the world of real world data, clinical research, pharmaceutical life sciences. What's your backstory?
Yeah, so actually it does go back to about fifth grade. That's the earliest memory I have of being interested in the medical field. I grew up with asthma, with severe asthma, still have it to this day, well controlled, you know, medically. But back then I was in and out of emergency rooms for asthma attacks and so forth, got exposure to this whole healthcare field. And again, around fourth or fifth grade, I believe, I started to think that I would like to be a doctor someday. Started to kind of go through that elementary and junior and high school with that idea of eventually I want to be a doctor and pursued that path. But as you can tell, certainly not doing clinical practice today. And there have been some really interesting kind of pivotal moments through that path along the way.
Okay. So it does, your interest in the medical field does go right back. And you mentioned that, I guess, those asthma stints kind of landed in A&E a couple of times. How that sounds pretty severe.
Yeah. So my father was in the military in the United States. Right. And we moved all over, which meant that my asthma and my kind of allergies and so forth waxed and waned at times. And there were times where it was more severe when we lived in the desert climates of Southern California. And that particular, during my seventh and eighth grade of grade school, I was almost monthly in the emergency kind of center for urgent care around my asthma. So again, a lot of exposure to the health field. From a young age, looking at clinicians as effectively kind of helping me, right? And saving me in a way from this acute medical condition. So I always had high regard for it. And again, thought someday I would love to be a doctor. And pursued that all through college. So even when I went into my undergrad training, I started off in the biology or microbiology as well. I kept moving around science degrees, knowing that someday I wanted to go to medical school. Funny enough, and we can kind of dive in a little bit, but I ended up graduating with a bachelor's degree in Italian before going to medical school and studying in medicine. But
how did that happen? I don't mind going off piece a little bit because I like a bit of a personal journey. How on earth did you end up with a degree in Italian when you were going down that route?
Yeah, so in the middle of undergrad, in the middle of college, I had an opportunity to go and serve as a missionary for my church, and I lived in Italy. So I learned Italian immersively, a little bit of study. Most of it was just kind of on the fly. Spent 2 years, fell in love with the culture. I relate heavily with my native Hawaiian culture, but my mother's side of the family has ancestry from Sicily. So I kind of got to know that side of my ancestry. So when I came back, I decided to focus on my science prerequisite for medical school, but didn't really understand why I needed to take classes like invertebrate anatomy or botany. So instead of doing a science degree, I did my degree in Italian. And it you know, frankly, it gave me a nice balance where I would go and spend half my time in the science classes and half my time in the humanities, somewhat fostering some of the kind of literature and creative science of the mind, if you will. I didn't fully appreciate that back then, but years later, I feel like I've kind of leveraged some of that training, just that other side of the brain that I didn't necessarily use heavily in pure science.
Sure. So look, I guess that was your academic background. What was your first venture into, I guess, industry or the real world, as we, you know, our parents probably have told us all, you know, at one point or another?
Yeah. So I'll kind of tie into that going through my medical training. So I started medical school. I was very fortunate to be able to decide between a few different schools that I got accepted to. And I know that's not always the case. And I ended up choosing to go to the University of Utah, which at the time I didn't realize how impactful that decision would be. University of Utah has a well-renowned training program in medical informatics, but I didn't even know what that was at the time. All I knew is in my second week of medical school, we were invited to go to a free pizza lunch to learn about this thing called informatics. And I was down for any free lunch. So I went to the free lunch and learned about this field of like applied computer science, applied information science and medicine, which, you know, many of us can think of as like electronic health records and those kinds of data sources in healthcare. And I just fell in love with it. And so you could almost draw my training trajectory on a graph where I started off thinking I would be a clinician, practicing clinician who dabbled in informatics. And by the time I was in my third year of medical school, I realized, wait, I actually really like this informatics side of things. Maybe I should do a master's in it. So I decided to do a master's in medical informatics. And then by the time I graduated from medical school, I took one extra year to complete my master's degrees. I actually kind of glossed over this, but I did a master's in medical informatics and a master's in public health. My public health master's degree is largely because of my interest in underserved patient populations. So just wanting to kind of get a better sense of that. So I took a year to finish the master's degrees and then went and started residency. And that's when I just really recognized a passion around the medical informatics side of the field rather than the healthcare. I was going into the field of medical imaging and radiology. And I remember distinctly sitting in front of a PAC system and looking at the NIST chest x-ray to interpret. Mm-hmm. And I was much more fascinated by how the systems were auto-routing medical images to the workstations and how they were calculating things like window and level settings.
Yeah.
I was much more fascinated about that than I was about the next x-ray or the next CT scan. And so it kind of dawned on me, maybe my future was not as a clinician, but rather maybe as a career in medical informatics. And in 2006, I decided to leave my career path and pursue a full-time career in informatics.
Wow. So what was it about the informatics that really fascinated you? What was, because again, like, it's, you know, it's quite rare from a young age to have such an interest in paths that are aligned, but clearly you've been knocked off path by the informatics or dragged off path because you liked it. But what was it that, you know, kind of stood out and kind of changed what you thought would be to what now is?
I think in the early days I just enjoyed the idea of computer science. I started to get a little dabbling into programming languages like Python and Java, but again, very kind of Java 101, if you will. And it was just fascinating, I think, about the potential to leverage the, you know, advancements in technology to support healthcare. This was, I was doing my training 2001 through 2006, started my residency in 2006 and decided to leave in 2007. So that was roughly the time period I was in. And you know, looking back on it, I think many of us started at that time period to realize that this idea of electronic health records was really about to take off. It was before many of the governments started putting in incentives around the adoption of electronic health records. But I think we kind of anticipated that. And so it was funny, like just because of my interests, while I was an intern at a hospital in Michigan, I was pulled away to go and evaluate EMR systems as vendors were pitching to the hospital. And I was like a lowly intern. And yet, just because of my interest, these other attending physicians would appreciate my input. And I really enjoyed that, right? And so I kind of really started to dig in and say, hey, well, maybe there's a career over there that I had not really appreciated before.
Mm. Interesting. And were there any particular individuals at that time? Because clearly the subject was of interest, but was there, you know, a primary mentor or somebody that you were looking up to who was saying, you know what, this could be, you could carve a career out of this? Or has it literally been quite exploratory and you've just gone one foot in front of the other each time?
So it certainly was exploratory, one foot in front of the other. However, yes, there were a few mentors that really stood out at the time when I was starting to make that decision. Because certainly, I think many can appreciate you going down the path of being a physician, the education, the medical school, the residency is a big investment, the loans and finances, it's a big investment. And it's quite a decision to decide to leave that path. And so there was a medical informaticist who had also gone through medical school, had decided not to do residency and was doing a full-time career in academics. That was one of my professors that really impressed me. And I kind of liked the kind of work he did. So he was kind of there. But there was a professor and a radiologist who was most closely my mentor, a Dr. David Averin, in fact. And I'll call him out as someone who really was impactful and a great mentor to me over many years. And I distinctly remember when I was applying for radiology residency, he being a radiologist and also an informaticist, he would call different director or different radiology programs on my behalf to give a reference. And he would hang up and look at my wife and I who were sitting on his couch in his office. Yeah. And he would say, guys, I really don't think you should do this. I think you should do a career in informatics, but I will continue to call on your behalf. So we spent all day. He was calling on my behalf and helping me get interviews. And I was going down that path. But it was months later that I reflected back on that moment where he had the foresight that I didn't have. And he helped open my mind to even consider this as a career.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I would mention is while I was going through this decision process as an intern at this hospital in Flint, Michigan, of all places, inner city Flint, Michigan, I called a friend who was about 4 years ahead of me in his medical education. And I was asking him some advice like, well, what do you think I should do? He ended up having a job and he ended up hiring me to Roche a few years later.
Wow.
But certainly a mentor of someone who was a little bit closer to me rather than a professor who was giving me some idea of real time kind of job opportunities in the field. Because once I decided to leave clinical medicine, I didn't know what it meant to have a career in informatics. So now I was trying to figure out, well, where do I even apply and what kind of jobs are even out there?
Okay. So look, I mean, what kind of jobs are there in informatics? You know, again, I work in the recruiting world, but my wheelhouse is clinical operations and project management. So for, you know, my benefit and our audience, what sort of positions are out there? What sort of, you know, what's the career progression like, if you were to outline that, Aaron?
Yeah, no, thank you. And I really appreciate the opportunity because I feel like there are many job opportunities and career opportunities in medical informatics that are even becoming more available today than certainly weren't available or has at least weren't so obvious when I was making the decision. When I was making the decision in 2006-07, I felt like, at least for myself, I felt like limited to either go back and get a PhD and work in academia or go and work for an EHR company. And there were a number of big and small EHR companies that had really grown around 2006 time period. And so I applied to those kinds of jobs. I ended up working at a relatively small startup like EHR company, and it gave me both opportunity to understand the EHR world, but it also gave me opportunity to understand the startup and entrepreneurial world, which both helped me down the road. But today, there are opportunities across the entire broad healthcare spectrum, whether you want to be more technical in the like programming and design of healthcare IT technologies. We think about a lot of the apps that are coming out today around health and wellness that all has informatics components behind it. interconnectivity, if any of us take a step back and think of ourselves as patients engaging in our own health and welfare and healthcare, the things we engage with all have some kind of informatics and data science component to it, which requires some kind of informaticist behind the scenes, managing between the clinical and kind of medical concepts and workflow and the data science component of things. And in many ways, you can think of a medical informaticist as a like an interpreter or a translator speaking technical language and medical language, and in my case, research languages, and bringing those fields together.
I can imagine it must be a massive area now, because everything is going with, you know, wearables and collecting data and kind of, you know, that analysis of it just must be huge now. So I can only imagine that the amount of opportunities out there, it must really broaden. So you need a specialist in this area, a specialist in that area. I don't know, like, you tell me, has it become quite compartmentalized in terms of that there's so many opportunities in that field now?
Yeah, so there are certainly kind of obvious compartments, like the EHR space, and a lot of EHR companies out there, pharma and life sciences space, and many of us looking for informaticists to hire into the field.
Yeah.
But the breadth is ever growing, and there are new job opportunities that probably none of us are conceiving of today that are going to be available next year. Because as you noted, I mean, we can even talk about the crazy speed at which AI is advancing and some of the technologies that are coming to light today. Mm. How is that going to impact healthcare across the board? In many ways, it's going to impact healthcare. And there needs to be informaticists who help drive and shape how we use these tools in the future. Those informaticists are needed today. So I think there's a heavy demand and relatively low supply in the field today.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to get onto the AI in healthcare. I had a guy on the show not so long about who was talking about ChatGPT and healthcare, and he's written a couple of books. Surname is escaping me now, but Harvey, I know I'm going to try and get back on the show in a not too distant future. But for yourself, you mentioned that you worked for kind of a smaller startup, and I believe that was looking at your LinkedIn profile before Roche.
Right.
That gave you that entrepreneurial insight, and I think sometimes it's good. I've worked for tiny organizations when they're like, it's myself, and I was going out with the CEO and then kind of went to other companies. But it does give you that insight as to how everything works from behind the scenes, and you understand the challenges. But for yourself, where did the business idea come from for, you know, Ikaika? Where, at what point was it you like, okay, I'm going to do this? Because, again, looking at your resume, I don't believe that this is necessarily your first venture in entrepreneurship, right? Is it? So talk to us about some of the other things that you've been involved in, and, yeah, where the idea for Ikaika came from.
Yeah, no, and thank you. I think the mindset to be a bit entrepreneurial originated from my parents.
Right.
My father was in the military. He joined the military as a way to effectively support going to college. He's the first person in his extended family to go to university, using the military as a way to kind of fund that. But also showing me through examples on how he drove his different leadership roles as an officer in the Army. And in many ways, kind of those leadership roles being somewhat entrepreneurial or intrapreneurial in terms of within an organization.
Yeah.
But when I was at Roche and Genentech, I had the opportunity, and I joined them in January 2008. So for those who kind of know the clinical research world, 2008 through 2010 and 11 was a time period in which a number of companies were really focusing on aggregating large amounts of real world data to help use that for things like pharmacoepidemiology and health economics and outcomes research in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some of us who are trying to figure out, how do we leverage those data to support clinical trials? And I ran the first pilot project at Roche and Genentech when the companies merged together in 2010 around using real world data to support patient recruitment in a phase 3 clinical trial. I supported a phase 3 trial design of a protocol using EHR data to support that. Mm-hmm. And very early days and little case studies here and there. But at the time, I was watching these companies do big aggregation of data, which usually meant that when you're aggregating data from large or from many sources, you're going to kind of narrow down to a common denominator of data that exists across all the data sources,
right,
which means you'll end up with very big but relatively shallow data. These data sources were very useful for a lot of use cases. But I had certain use cases from my Genentech colleagues who were asking for details around oncology care patterns and oncology treatment or patient populations that didn't exist in many of the commercial real data at the time.
Yeah.
And I knew that data was back behind the firewall in this EHR systems and these health systems because I had worked in the EHR world before Roche and Genentech. And so I decided to leave in 2011 and start a company where we would partner directly with healthcare systems. And we would tell them, instead of aggregating the data, let's leave it all behind your firewall, but let's leverage all the depth and richness and robustness of it to support a variety of use cases in pharma. Wow. And ran that company.
I'm just thinking, I mean, it sounds very complex to, I guess, the untrained ear. What does that involve, Aaron? I guess kind of leaving it behind the firewall. Is it a simpler process? Was it more the idea that was different, or was it actually the doing of it?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it certainly was a bit more complex because it required that the institutions I partnered with would be able to manage and use that data in a way that I needed to for research questions. So I was intentionally targeting health systems that already had an informatics infrastructure, and they're a number of them out there, like an Intermountain Healthcare, Kaiser, Northwestern Medical Center, some of these health systems that had adopted EHR systems and had an informatics team. So I could go to them and say, hey, I have a project on behalf of this pharma sponsor. This is the kind of data I need to answer these questions. Let's work together. You dig into the data and query the data in the way that I specify so that we can answer the questions. So it wasn't simple. It was fairly complex, which means we had to work with certain health systems, but it allowed us to get to certain data that at the time, certainly in 2011, just wasn't available to us in the life sciences industry. And it's now starting to become more available today, but certainly not 12 years ago.
Okay. You've got me thinking now. So what outcomes were you looking to achieve by having that data? Because I guess people tend to, they're not just doing stuff for the sake of it. They're looking for a particular outcome, aren't they? So what was the mission with that, or what was the outcome that you were trying to pin down or to achieve?
Yeah. So some examples would be like in the oncology space, when we need to understand, let's say I did a study for Roche and Genentech. It's been published, so it's out there in the public domain.
Yeah.
Where they were looking to identify patients who had quote unquote advanced basal sarcocarcinoma.
Uh-huh.
And they defined advanced because they had a drug that recently got FDA approval. Advanced was defined as either metastatic basal cell carcinoma or locally advanced. And locally advanced was defined as either the patient was contraindicated to surgery, couldn't have surgery for some reason, or surgery would result in significant deformity.
Right.
That concept, clinical concept, makes sense, right? We could talk about that and say, oh, I understand a patient may not be able to have surgery and therefore they need this medication instead. However, to find that in data, especially in structured kind of claims or medical administrative data, is very hard. In fact, almost impossible to find. And so we would go to health systems directly rather than to aggregated data. And we would go look at clinical notes and reports and pathology reports and about these patients to try to curate that information out and understand if that patient qualified as being locally advanced or metastatic.
Wow.
Now, today, there are a number of companies who have come to the market in the last 5 or 6 years who do a lot of that curation process and can bring that to life sciences. But back in 2010 and 2011, those companies didn't exist yet. So we were doing this very manually at the time. And you can appreciate similar things for other rare diseases or neuroscience diseases where you just need to find more detailed information about a patient population. Sometimes it's part of their inclusion criteria. Sometimes it's part of their outcome measures that just wasn't available in the traditionally available data at the time.
Yeah. Wow. It blows my mind that, you know, these sort of things can be calculated just off the back of data. Yeah, it's just it's crazy. So that was kind of what you were doing then, and you say that things have come on somewhat since then. I guess to the back to the question of when Ikaika started, what prompted that move? Was there a specific event, turner of events, or was it something else that made you think, I'm going to go and do this? And what did the business look like from at day one?
Yeah. So the first business that I was referring to is called Analinks. And ran that, we did that for about 6.5 years. I had a team of upwards of 6 to 8 full-time employees at any given time, mostly pharmacoepidemiologists in the field, a couple of statisticians and a couple of informaticists. And we were acquired by ParXL. So ParXL, one of the big CROs, looking to build out their real-world data science function. And so they acquired Analinks and then brought us in. And I spent a couple of years building out this function. Gave me some great visibility to the industry as a whole, looking at what other sponsors were trying to accomplish, identifying some of the gaps in the industry and so forth. I ended up leaving ParXL at the end of December, in fact, 2019. Of course, none of us knew what was going to happen the next year.
Anytime I hear that those sort of dates, Aaron, I'm like, oh, right, okay, so that's when you made a change. I'm just thinking, what's coming next?
I know, right? And so, frankly, I took a couple of months off and really spent a lot of time with family. As anyone knows, being entrepreneurial, it's very, very busy. Yeah. And so I took a couple of months off through February of 2020. So in March, I'm now going to start doing some independent consulting, right? Mm-hmm. That's my thought, which I ended up doing. And I named the entity Ikaika Health. Again, I mentioned kind of strong health, something that was a meaningful word to me.
Yeah.
But really, it's a company that was a vehicle for me to use to do independent consulting and advisory services in the field. And then, of course, COVID hit, right? And we, many of us know, but and many of your audience may fully appreciate this, just a massive kind of focus around how we leverage data to accelerate drug development across the board, certainly within COVID specifically. But as we started seeing vaccine development and treatment development and kind of accelerations in clinical research in COVID and infectious diseases, we were also looking at how we could leverage these methods to support other drug development activities as well. Not if it can work for infectious diseases, why can't it work for, and name an indication?
Yeah.
And so that really accelerated it. I thought I was going to consult for a year or so as I thought about what my next endeavor would be. And here we are 3-4 years later, already, or I guess, in my fourth year now of consultancy and doing projects. I have some subcontractors working under me on different projects, still very much an independent endeavor, but a lot of interest in how we can push the envelope and innovate using real-world data to support drug development.
Sure. I guess quick question on that. I guess you've gone from having a successful business that you managed to sell to, one of the big, well-known CROs like ParXL. How does it now change kind of going back to, I guess, being an independent consultant? I know you mentioned you've got a few sub-consultants and you work, sounds like there's a few of you that, collaborate. But how is that from kind of having a business, building a small team, becoming part of a much bigger business to then going back to working independently? How has that played with kind of your own mindset? Because it must be so different, right?
It is. And it is a very different environment, as you're alluding to, of course. The big CRO environment was a great experience for me. Like I mentioned, I got exposure to things like the randomized clinical trial side of the equation that I wasn't as familiar with, having spent most of my career in just kind of real-world data and real-world evidence. I got exposure to a lot of the other kind of activities that go into drug development. It's a very complex process, as many people understand. I got to see a lot of what other pharma companies are doing and trying to accomplish. I do recognize that personally, I enjoy the small, or environment. I enjoy the entrepreneurial experience. as a little bit of a teaser, I am working on my next adventure, if you will, in this space, and looking to launch a new business in this space in the near future. Not intending to be an independent consultant for forever, but because one of the theses that I've kind of grabbed onto and learned over the last few years is that we've just had this explosion of use cases of real world data in life sciences. We're trying to do more with real world data than we ever have before, and our stakeholders are becoming more and more sophisticated and complex, like the regulatory agencies, like the FDA and EMA, China's NMPA, like payer organizations and health technology assessment organizations. And so as everybody becomes more sophisticated, we have this plethora of real world data solutions on the market, which actually makes it a bit challenging for life science companies to navigate the landscape. And that's where I've found a lot of success for myself, and in fact, where I plan to kind of evolve my consultancy into a new business, is really helping pharma companies navigate the landscape and identify the best solutions to meet their needs. And so I've been very fortunate over the last few years to be kind of somewhat independent, kind of keep my finger on the pulse, see how things are evolving, and start to identify some areas where I feel I bring kind of maybe some unique value proposition to the industry.
Sure. I guess, look, for anyone else that is, you know, perhaps going down the independent consultant route and looking to identify opportunities, as it seems that you are, you know, with things boiling away in the background there and potential new business ventures on the horizon, you know, what would you say are some of the biggest challenges for people becoming independent consultants? Because there's perhaps a lot more personal risk, you know, rather than being under the banner of an organization. Again, you've already spoken about your own father kind of giving you that entrepreneurial spirit, but, you know, what other qualities or habits and attitudes do you think that perhaps you have that are required to make a successful independent consultant? And, you know, going one step beyond that, to move from an independent consultant to kind of, you know, launching a new business. Because there's loads of people that approach me and say, James, what do you think about this? You know, I kind of went from being an employee to running my business, but it's a completely different sector. And it's, you know, it was my wheelhouse. But, you know, how is it for yourself? What are the, you know, the potential pitfalls that people could run into? What are the benefits? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think that there is, I tend to think very analytically and like frameworks, if you will. So in my mind, there's kind of a few buckets that you're trying to fill in terms of competencies or experience when you're doing independent consultancy in particular. And independent meaning, on your own, like hang your shingle and kind of out for business. One is certainly the subject matter expertise. And I think there are a number of people out there who certainly have the expertise and experience. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the harder part. I think that I see a number of experts try to kind of hang their shingle, and it's their first time doing something as a new business that there are just enough business kind of regulations. What does it mean to start a company? What does it mean to like file for taxes or account for all your business expenses or some of the just logistics or operational kind of things of owning a business that I was fortunate to learn firsthand when I started my first business. So second time around, I already had some kind of knowledge of how I wanted to set some of those logistics up in a way that would make it easier for my day-to-day. So I wouldn't have to spend many hours every week just trying to manage the logistics of the business. And then the third part, which I think is probably the hardest part, is how do you drum up business? How do you approach clients and let them know that you're available to be hired and what your business model is? Some people come with that experience. Many of us were figuring that out on the fly. I had an inkling that I wanted to move this direction for some time while I was still in my former employment. So I had already started to kind of prepare, if you will, my network of colleagues and friends out there in the industry. So when I left Parexel, I don't think it surprised many people when I started telling them, hey, I'm available as a consultant or as an advisor now.
Yeah.
And kind of set up a little bit of what is my rate? What is a fair market value rate? What, you know, what are those kind of business model around being able to hire me? What would that look like?
It's that networking and business development side of things, because you could be incredible at whatever it is you do, but if nobody knows what you do and you don't have the connections, it's kind of irrelevant. You know, you can bury your head in the sand as much as you like at a big organization and be very good at what you do, very comfortable, and earn a fortune. However, as soon as you go independent, it's all on you. So you not only need the ability, you need to be able to get out there and, as you say, you know, pick up the business. And it sounds like you preempted that by, you know, getting your face out there, however you did it, just networking, so that it wasn't a surprise when you kind of hit the button to say, hey guys, I'm now available.
I learned firsthand how to sell to pharma at Analinks, my first business, because that was the only way that could survive, right? When I left Roche and Genentech and started Analinks, I knew I had enough business to cover my salary for 6 months. And I told my wife, you know, we might be looking for another job in 6 months, or hopefully we can turn this into something that would last longer. And the only way that happens is selling to clients, right? Selling services to clients. And turned it into 6.5 years. And so I learned firsthand the challenges and the ability to do that. And so by the time I'm starting Ikaika Health, I already had a foundation. Like you said, I kind of preempted a little bit in terms of no one was surprised, I don't think, when I started to hang my shingle. But I also had an ability and had learned, you know, what is it that a client's needs are? What do our pharma clients need? And how can I help fill that gap or help support them? And how can I present myself in a way that they recognize it's something worth paying for? At the end of the day, right? Nothing is anything unless it's something a client's worth paying for when you think about it from an entrepreneurial perspective.
Aaron, you know what you're speaking, and my partner Lucy and I were talking about this just earlier today. It's about knowing your audience, isn't it? And your audience is your potential client or customer, end user. You need to understand, forget what you do. It's almost, what do they want? What problems do they have? What headaches do they have? If you can learn how to solve those problems, then you've got a business. You know, you then need to get out there and put yourself in front of those people to do that. But that is the challenge, isn't it? And we say it to people all of the time. Like, we get approached as recruiters, you know, people will send me over a random message saying, hey, James, can you review my profile and see what I'm suitable for? I'm like, no, I can't. But if you can solve one of my problems, let's talk. And it's the same when I approach clients. And it seems that you've realized that and you've nailed that. And I think that is the big thing that people, and just, you know, your general FTE employee could take from independent consultants is knowing that actually the best way to sell yourself and to get hired, promoted, and, you know, accelerate your career is to understand other people's problems and position yourself to solve them.
You know, when I was, and 100% agree, when I was early in my medical training, very early in medical school, I met a pathologist who like taught me this lesson. And it was funny because you think of like pathology and radiology. I had a number of family members. When I decided I wanted to be a radiologist early in that training, I had a number of family members saying, well, you're too good as a people person. Like, you engage people. You don't want to go hide away in a dark room. Pathologists sometimes have a reputation of hiding away in a lab, which they don't do. They're just doing incredible science. That's just their job. I sat in a hospital in the physician's kind of restroom, kind of like where they, you know, have food and kind of relax and kind of a little lounge area. And I saw this pathologist spent almost more time in the lounge than he did in the lab. And as another doctor would walk in the door, he would immediately say, hey, how is your patient? I remember I read these slides. I have these tissue samples. You let me know if we need anything else. Like, he was just constantly engaging other clinicians. And it clicked for me. He recognized that the other physicians were his clients. Their clients were their patients. His clients were the physicians. And he was putting himself out there to just be accessible to them, to be available to them. And so I always carried that story forward and thought the same thing. Recognize who your clients are. And it doesn't matter if you're an independent consultant or you're starting a new business, or you're a full, as you were mentioning, a full-time employee in a large corporation. There's always an internal somebody or team that you're supporting in some way. Maybe it's your management, whoever it is. And if you can understand what their needs are and how they define success, then you can say, here's how I support your success. That's how you win, I think. Right? That's
100%.
How you...
100%. Oh, yeah, for me, you've absolutely nailed it. We're you know, trying to hammer this home with people all the time. So it's just good to hear it from a third party. But look, Aaron, I guess talking about your own successes, you know, you've been going independent for a while. You've had success with the business. What would you say has been the biggest, I guess, what have you rated yourself as maybe the top one or two success stories? You know, was it selling the company? Because again, a lot of people have their big dream of, I'm going to build a company, I'm going to sell it. Has it been something else? What's been that one thing where you've been like, yes, I've made it, or whatever it may be?
So that's a great question. There are a number of events that are important. I have a little plaque up here on my shelf of the time in which my company was acquired by Parexel Annaly. So certainly an important event. Starting Ikaika Health, an important event. I actually think of my biggest success in the ability to network, to be accessible, I frankly really think of most, if not all, of the people I work with as friends. As colleagues, I like to get to know them personally. It's not just a business acquaintance relationship. And that's not something that was tied to any one event, right? That was kind of just genuine interest in other people and their careers and passions and frankly, their challenges and so forth. And so then it kind of makes me accessible to them as a resource, whether it's to hire as a consultant or even just as a friend, similar as I'm sure you have had similar experiences. I have a number of friends who will reach out to me, say, hey, I'm thinking about leaving my employment. What other opportunities might be out there? I'm more than happy to just have those friendly discussions and figure things out together. And so I feel like that, I mean, again, it's not exactly your question around a single event per se, but that tends to just come back almost daily to me. The fact that I have developed just genuine relationships with so many people, and I learn from everybody and look for opportunities where I can be helpful to them in whatever they're working on as well.
Awesome. Well, it seems like you've been quite grounded throughout your entire journey, Aaron, and in terms of, you know, no matter what the change has been, you've taken it in your stride. And just like I said early on, that kind of one step at a time. But I guess now talking about these things, and I don't know, a bit of reflection time maybe, do you think that you've changed since starting out? Or is there anything that you now do differently to what you did prior to starting a business, to selling a business and to going independent? What, you know, is there anything or?
I think the core of the way I approach kind of life and my career is pretty similar. It's certainly grown. I've appreciated more of the diverse ways in which people work in industry, not just in our industry broadly. I like to listen to podcasts about other startup businesses and technology and stuff as well, and think, hey, how might that, you know, how might I learn something from that, whether it's a method or whether it's just how to be a better kind of, you know, person in my career. But I do think that the things that have changed most significantly is my kind of understanding of like business and operational logistics, right? Like certainly, I used to joke, I feel like I was very fortunate and took a good opportunity when I started Analinks in the model that we were partnering with health systems and providing these services to pharma, that the model was good enough that it overshadowed all of my business mistakes along the way. I certainly made plenty of them along the way and learned from them. And despite them, we still had a successful business. Certainly learning those things and not repeating some of those mistakes and and make new mistakes, but being able to kind of pivot and move along the way, that has certainly changed.
Yeah.
But I think my genuine, like I truly just love the field and I have a passion about what we're working on. And I love to work with everyone that we work with in the field. And I think that just, that core has always been there and it's just kind of enhanced over time, if you will.
Awesome stuff. Well, it sounds like you've had an enjoyable journey, a successful journey. I'll be interested to see what this new venture is all about when you announce that. So do keep me posted. I know that we're now connected on LinkedIn, so I'll look forward to that update. But look, before I let you go, we always finish the show with, I guess, a quick fire questions round, really. Yeah. So I guess it seems that you're very in tune with your younger self. The fact that you're, you know, dating stuff back to fifth grade. But what is the one piece of advice, Aaron, that you would give to your younger self?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. In fact, funny enough, I have three kids in college right now. So I feel like I'm imparting to them things that I wish I had learned when I was younger. Uh-huh. One of the things I would say is be willing to put yourself out there. Like if I could talk to myself back in early college days, just say, be willing to put yourself out there and take risks. Mm-hmm. I do feel like eventually I got to the point where I started to take those risks, like leaving Roche and Genentech and starting Analinks was certainly a leap of faith, if you will. But I do wish I would have had a better appreciation earlier, before starting a family even or whatever, to like take those risks and be willing to fail and learn from those failures and move along, you know, quickly from those. That would have been something I probably could have benefited from earlier in my career.
Awesome stuff. And my next quick fire question is, you mentioned a second ago about listening to other podcasts and things like that. Is there, you know, one book or resource that you would perhaps recommend for our audience? Doesn't necessarily need to be healthcare or clinical research related, but anything that you would recommend?
Yeah, thank you so much. I somehow just a few years ago happened upon a doctor, Dr. Peter Attia. So I'll give him a plug. I don't know him personally. Maybe someday we'll meet. I would love to. I'm kind of a fanboy for Dr. Attia. Awesome. Peter Attia, A-T-T-I-A, who has his own podcast, but also just came out with a book called Outlive. I am partway through it, but it's a lot about health span and longevity and really to how to kind of live a healthier life and avoid some of the big kind of medical reasons that might cause, you know, morbidity and mortality later in life. And I'm totally fascinated by it. So I'm happy to recommend Peter Attia's book, Out to Live.
Oh, you've highlighted something there. I think that my partner Lucy is going to be very interested in. So I'm going to have to get into the house and tell her about that one. She's become obsessed with that subject. So it's a good one.
She'll love it.
And look, I guess we talk a lot about work on this podcast, but there's always the individual outside of work and what people do to relax. I know that you spoke about your family being from Hawaii, which I'm very jealous about just because of the weather, being in grey, miserable London a lot of the time. But look, what is your favourite thing, Aaron, outside of work?
You know, I love getting outdoors. So, you know, I think that alone, people won't be surprised to learn that I live full time in Utah, just north of Salt Lake City area, and love to get out and hike a little bit of trail running. I mean, call it fast hiking. I'm not super fast, but I enjoy being out in nature, in the sun. I snowboard in the winter. When we go to Hawaii, I try to get out on our paddleboard as much as I can. Just getting outside and being a little bit one with nature. I love it.
Very active man by the sounds of it. Very active. And look, to close the show, Aaron, I guess finally, what is your number one golden rule for both life and business? If you're able to wrap that one up, a bit of a deep one, but if you can, that'd be amazing.
You know, I think actually, and maybe it's because you said the word golden rule that it's already coming to mind, but I think that the very nature, as I've already talked about, of trying to be genuine and truly kind of show a genuine interest and love for other people, that comes with that consideration of the typical golden rule of do unto others as you would have others do unto you. I just feel like the more we put other people ahead of ourselves, the more we all will be successful. And I don't need to focus so much on like the immediate thing I might get, it will come. And so I think as we just put each other ahead of ourselves and look for those opportunities to serve other people, life will be good.
Awesome. Well, look, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, Aaron. For anyone that, you know, is looking to reach out to yourself or find out more about Ikaika, I know that you've got your Real Well Wednesdays. It's a bit of a tongue twister there for me, that you host on Clubhouse. So we'll, you know, signpost people to that. But where else can people find you?
Yeah, people can find me most easily on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Aaron Kamau, so K-A-M-A-U-U, as people will see, or A Kamau, I think is the shortened version of it on LinkedIn, but that should be pretty easy to find a unique last name there. And as you mentioned, we do, I partner with Matt Veach and we do a weekly live discussion on Clubhouse that we release as a recording on a podcast as well. And people can find more information there at rwd-rwe.club.
Okay, awesome. Well, look, we'll get that all tagged up. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks for joining me on the Huxley Morton podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, James.